from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll chat with Gail Holtman, the president of VSAI.
I'll find out what's going on this fall at the Indiana Historical Society.
And I'll get a preview of a new documentary on WFYI-TV about a lost Shakespeare play. It's calendar we call...
What'll we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. VSAI's mission is to provide access to lifelong learning and creative expression through the arts for people with disabilities in Indiana. Travis DiNicola spoke with VSAI's president and CEO, Gail Holtman, about the organization.
Gail, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you.
Thanks for having me here.
Absolutely. So VSAI, which has gone through some other names, VSA Indiana, different things, but basically give me the, let's start with the quick overview of what is VSAI, what do those letters stand for, and what are you guys all about?
Yeah, VSA has gone through a lot of organizational names. Unfortunately, it makes it really hard for people to keep track of us. We're all about access and inclusion for people with disabilities through the arts. And so the VSA originally stood for Very Special Arts.
Sure.
And if you think about Special Olympics, mm-hmm. our founder is Ambassador Jean Kennedy Smith, so there's the connection there.
Okay.
And I don't know, maybe 15 years ago, the national organization decided that all kids are special, so they contracted the name to VSA, and then even just 2 years ago, they changed it again. So
there you are. So
yeah.
So we're VSAI here.
Yes.
But it is the local, the state affiliate of a national organization.
This is true.
Okay.
VSA is actually an international organization. There are 37 states that have a VSA affiliate, and then there are actually more countries that have some sort of VSA activity.
Very cool. And is it limited to kids, or it's all ages?
It's all ages. There is a focus on youth and kids. The funding for VSA National comes from the Federal Department of Education. So, of course, there's going to be a focus on a school-age
sure.
person.
So tell me a bit about, let's start with who most of your clients are here locally.
Well, we do serve statewide, mm-hmm. but I would say about 75% of our activity, especially in the last couple of years, have been in Marion and the contiguous counties. So we serve in central Indiana, and also I would say about 75% are either adults or youth. We've mm-hmm. actually seen a drop in the number of children that we serve, and we think there are a couple of reasons for that. One, the change in the school calendar has made it harder for kids to get to our studios in the Harrison Center.
Mm-hmm.
And there probably are a few other reasons for that. But so we primarily serve adults, and I would say younger adults, like 40 and younger, and youth, so teenagers. Most of the people we serve are low income. And also I would say a lot of the people we serve, to look at them, you wouldn't know that they had a disability.
Mm-hmm.
We think very broadly about disability, so anyone is welcome. And in fact, our philosophy, our model is to do inclusive programming, which is to say anyone is welcome. And on average, about 80 to 90% of our participants have some sort of identified disability. And then the remaining 10 to 20 do not. And they can be siblings or neighbors
sure.
or friends or just someone who likes the atmosphere of our space. But,
and
yeah.
you guys have a great space.
We're
fortunate to have that great space at the Harrison Center over on 16th and Delaware, both studio space and gallery space.
We are very fortunate. We were, as I understand it, the first tenant to move in there about 12 years ago. And so we do have three studio spaces. And so we do a lot of visual arts activities, but we also do drama and writing and music and movement. We just tend to do more visual arts, I think because it's so tactile.
Mm-hmm.
And interactive in that very Well, very tactile way. And then also, I think, you know, it produces something that you can, as a participant, take with you and show to somebody. Whereas with music, it's a little harder. We have recorded CDs, and so that provides something tangible, but it's easier with visual arts, I think.
Now, the work that you do, again, within Marion County and sort of surrounding areas, for the most part, people come to you at your location at the Harrison Center. But do you also go out?
We do a lot of work in our studios at the Harrison Center. We have two programs that are ongoing. One is a series of community arts classes, and the other one is a vocational program for high school students. Mm-hmm. So those are ongoing at our studios at the Harrison Center. But we also are regularly in schools and a few other settings in central Indiana. We have an ongoing relationship with Indianapolis Public Schools, mm-hmm. Pike Township, and to a shorter degree, some other schools around the community. So we go out to their settings, and it's always a toss-up. You know, in the special education world, it is something that the teachers look for, opportunities to get their students out of the classroom, which is an opportunity for them to integrate more fully into the community, to experience more, mm-hmm. to develop some interests that they might hang on to after they leave school. But then there are also schools where it's really hard to leave the school, the whole issue about getting a bus and a driver and then, you know, all the time away for the travel. So we do a little bit of both, on-site and off-site.
And then what else do you do throughout the state? Because I know you are in other communities throughout the entire state.
Well, one of the things that we do also on a regular basis off-site is go into Riley Hospital, both downtown and now Riley North, and St. Vincent Peyton Manning, and a few other hospitals around the state where we're working with the kids. And this is a really cool project. It's called the Lolly Project.
I saw that on your website.
Did you?
Yeah.
Lolly was an amazing special education teacher by all accounts. I unfortunately never had the chance to meet her. And when she, and this is one of my favorite stories about VSA, when she died prematurely, her service sorority sisters decided that they would create this project in her memory. And so this is the Psi Iota Xi mm-hmm. chapters around the state and the state association that do all sorts of really grassroots activities to raise money, which they send to VSA, which then covers the costs of sending a teaching artist into these hospitals to work with the kids. And the hospital staff, and in particular the what's called a child life specialist, which is a professional licensed mm-hmm. person, really love these opportunities. It's not about therapy. We know that there's a therapeutic effect to what goes on, but it's about respite. It's about dealing with a sense of isolation that comes with illness, chronic illness, and disability. And frankly, enjoyment. You know, when kids are sick and not feeling well, any opportunity that you can to distract them and give mm-hmm. them something to look forward to. It also gives them some choices.
For almost everybody.
Yeah, really.
I mean, I was going to ask you, you know, I mean, do you try to distinguish between, you know, the therapeutic side, the art therapy side, and just making art at all? But
we're really pretty clear about that, and it's an important distinction because our teaching artists, and that's mm-hmm. that's a key means of understanding VSA, the teaching artist is a person who delivers our program, and I can go on and talk mm-hmm. about them in a bit if you want, but they are not therapists. They're not trained, and that's really an important thing for people to understand.
They're there to make art.
Yeah, they're there to make art. They're not there to necessarily try to fix anybody. They're there to meet people where they are and take them wherever they like to go. And so it's not about therapy as a formal intent. Mm-hmm. It's more about an opportunity for choices. Also, kids don't get a lot of choices when they're sick and in the hospital. Things are being done to them on somebody else's schedule. Just enjoyment, a chance to be creative and expressive.
So in addition to the classes that you have at the Harrison Center and the other programs that you have, including the Lolly Project, you've got a great art gallery space that it's open on First Fridays at the Harrison Center, the InRoot Gallery. Tell me a bit about this, because it's a great way, I think, for people to maybe make that first connection with you.
It is a great way. The gallery is in our hallways and our studios in the Harrison Center, and we are part of IDOTA, so every First Friday we are there, and it's a great opportunity to to better understand what does disability mean in terms of art making and creativity. And one of the things that VSA is trying to accomplish is to help people understand that disability doesn't preclude people from being able, from being creative, mm-hmm. from being capable. And that is reflected in these finished products. You know, to be honest, also the process of art making is really important to VSA, but we also do have these finished products. And so we have some for display only and some for sale. And people can come and not only see the artwork, but they can see the teaching artists and mm-hmm. read a little bit about who these people are and why they do this work. They can meet some of the artists. The artists are frequently there to talk about their work. And so it's also another way to kind of get beyond this sense of disability as something separate from me. It doesn't have anything to do with me. It's, you know, it's natural. It's part of most people's life experience.
Well, I definitely encourage most people to, you know, when you're out on First Friday, especially the next one coming up, and you're at the Harrison Center, go by VSA and check it out. It's also a great place to pick up some holiday gifts, too.
It is. And in November, our First Friday will be all about draw the vote. And so we're going to have some New England chowder, but also some Midwestern stew for our presidential campaign options. And then we'll also have some art making activity, which is pretty typical for us.
Great.
We will obviously have soup and chowder bowls, so people can buy those, and a variety of other things as well.
Very fun. That sounds yeah. excellent. I'll be sure to swing by. Gail, thank you so much for coming by today.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Travis DiNicola with Gail Holtman, President and CEO of VSAI. For more information about VSAI, visit vsai.org, vsai.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
The Indiana Historical Society has made another fascinating photograph, the basis of a You Are There exhibition. And Sharon Gamble invited the Society's Director of Education and Community Engagement, Aaron Kelly, and Media Relations Manager, Amy Lamb, in to tell us about that new prospect and lots more initiatives going on at the Indiana History Center this fall.
So it feels like a sudden transition. The last time, Amy, that you were here, we were talking about concerts on the canal outside. Mm-hmm. It's a little too cool for concerts on the canal, but that doesn't stop you all. And so let's talk about November and December. I want to especially hear about the new Town Hall series. Mm-hmm. Aaron, Amy, whoever is the best person to talk about that.
I can take that one. The Indiana Town Hall series is a program series that we began in 2008, and it is a way for the Historical Society to use history to look at a contemporary issue and to think about it and to talk about it. So in the past, we've done Town Hall series on immigration, the environment, social justice, and this year we're looking at the issue of healthcare. So previously, earlier in October, we did a wonderful series on vaccines and the history of vaccines. And then in November,
tied into the You Are There
exhibit. Tied into, mm-hmm. yeah, Eli Lilly, the ending polio exhibit, yes. Mm-hmm. So in November, on November 1st at 7 o'clock, we're going to be taking a look at healthcare disparity and access. It is a program that's actually moderated by Barbara Lewis, Sound Medicine, mm-hmm. so we're excited to have her on board. And we're going to bring together a medical historian, Bill Schneider, from IUPUI, along with Antoinette Holt, who is with the Office of Minority Health at the State Department of Health, Carl Ellison, who's with the Indiana Minority Health Coalition, and Mercy Obamey, who is a physician for St. Francis, but she also runs the Mercy Foundation and does work overseas in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. So it's an opportunity for us to, again, use history, talk about the issue of healthcare access and disparity, and then use that history to engage all of these folks in a nice, robust conversation about issues that we are facing today. And maybe, you know, to help us think a little creatively about how we can face these issues in the future.
And so perfectly timed. I know in another part of your life, you're involved with the League of Women Voters, and
yes.
this is right before the election, so there will be questions. I mean, sometimes, and I don't know much about the history of healthcare in our country, let alone other places, and sometimes people start talking politics and they just fling things around about socialized medicine and this and that, without necessarily having that background that they need. So this is a great opportunity to ask those questions.
It is, and it fits in very nicely with our newest exhibit, You Are There, 1939, Changing Minds, Healing Bodies.
Healing Bodies, Changing Minds.
Thank you. I knew I was going to get that wrong. It's the story of Dr. Harvey Middleton, who was an early African-American physician in Indiana, in Indianapolis. And, you know, one of the things we've uncovered while researching that exhibit and planning for this program is that many of the issues that minority communities faced in the 1930s regarding healthcare access are the same issues individuals face today.
No kidding.
Not just in minority communities, but wider. And the access to a physician who is in your community, someone who is of the same ethnicity, cultural, or religious background as you, a male or female physician, all of those things that some of us take for granted in helping us feel comfortable approaching a physician, and those things that, you know, make medicine accessible to us, issues that existed in the past exist today. So it's really kind of a fascinating comparison.
And in some ways, they're more complicated today because now there are so many more areas of specialty within the medical profession. So
And actually, Dr. Middleton, it's interesting. He was a family physician, but at the same time, he was also making personal investment of time, resources in cardioelectrographic technology. So he was actually working with, he was a cardiologist. So he was taking his own time, his own money, rather than having a hospital send him for training. He ends up going overseas to London to get lots of training. So actually, the setting on June 24th, 1939, which is before he's made a lot of strides in the area, because he goes on to work at City Hospital, to work for St. Vincent, to work for Methodist, and really builds a reputation as a cardiologist. Here he is having to go overseas to get the training that he really wants to have on the latest and greatest technology, because that's not really available to him here. So that opens November 15th. So we want to make sure that people know that they can come to the Indiana Town Hall series and then come visit us later.
Yeah.
But certainly we have a lot of original materials in our collection too. So people can venture up to the library during regular operating hours and check out some of what Dr. Middleton's life was like.
How did that photo surface? Was it part of a collection of his papers and other
items? It's one of the 1.8 million photographs we have in our collection. And it's, you know, they're disposed. Photos that jump out at you and you fall in love with. And it's a wonderful photo of Dr. Middleton and his sister Ollie Mae in his office, and she's strapped into the cardiac machine, the early electrocardiograph machine.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so we're recreating that office and trying to tell the story of Dr. Middleton and his life and his family here in Indiana.
Yeah, and we actually, we don't collect artifacts as a matter of course, because we are primarily an archival facility, but we actually own one of Dr. Middleton's cardiograph machines, one of his cardiac machines. And so people will actually be able to get in touch, if you will, with a real piece of his past. And I think it's always amazing to me how you can take letters and newspaper clippings and all of these paper written sources and turn it into something that's living and something that you can really get inside and experience.
Yeah, something that's three-dimensional and emotional too. Mm-hmm. You mentioned City Hospital for people who might not know what City Hospital was.
Eventually turned into Wishard, which is now the Eskenazi Health Center. And, you know, it was basically the first place that people could go for care at that point. And he eventually receives admitting rights. He was one of the earliest black doctors to receive admitting rights to City Hospital. But before that, he actually volunteered in the clinic that City Hospital had. So he was doing things very quietly and somewhat independently, but doing what he could to make his community a better place, which I think is something that we can take away today. You know, just because one door is shut to you doesn't mean that you can't make a difference.
How do you decide what add-on activities or programming, and the answer is probably different in every single case, but so did this idea start with the photograph, or did it start with, gee, healthcare is a hot topic that we don't seem to be anywhere close to any resolution. Is there something in our collection that would illustrate and help us take a historical view of healthcare? What was the first domino in this?
I think the first domino, it was just a great photograph that was suggested to us. And I'll be honest, that's where we tend to start, is looking for photos that just sort of jump out at you and make you think, what's going on there? What's the story behind that? Because if a photo does that, then chances are we can build a really wonderful you are there experience around it if the photo alone makes you want to learn more. And of course, through researching the life of Dr. Middleton and the African-American community in Indianapolis at that time, which, you know, this photo set at the tail end of the Great Depression. So that's a really interesting time period for us to explore because we haven't explored it yet in the You Are There series. But through all of that research, it just sort of, it just made sense, really. It was just kind of self-evident that we should do a program related to healthcare. We had the Ending Polio, You Are There, so there was a tie-in as well. But again, these issues of healthcare access and disparity, it's timely, it's relevant, and we can use history to talk about it, hopefully in a very civil and civic-minded way.
Sure. Well, and the other thing, too, you know, there you have to be able to reproduce the photograph, and you have to be able to find out things about the people, about the place, about the time, you know, the kind of the larger picture. And, you know, sometimes when we're doing research, we get doors shut in our face. Maybe there are some real-life characters that we want to bring to life. Some of them we're going to find what we need in order to authentically recreate them as a character, and sometimes we're not. So one other thing that Aaron's department is in charge of, we do some behind the Indiana Experience programming, which is free and open last Wednesday of every month, 12:30 to 1:30. And you can find out how we bring these photographs to life. And maybe it's about how we did research on a particular character or how we found out about, for example, next spring, we're going to be opening up a You Are There on the 1913 flood. A city underwater. So, you know, how do we take these little itty bits that start the process and turn them into something real? So we want to encourage people to check those out as well.
Does Dr. Middleton have family here still? Children, grandchildren?
He does. We've actually talked with one of his grandsons. And it's really interesting because most people, when they hear his name and they know of him in the community, it's for something that happened much later than 1939. He actually was married three times, and he had children with his third wife. So, you know, it's really interesting. A lot of the things that people know about the Middleton family haven't taken place yet. So 1939 is going to be a different kind of spin. Surprises around every corner.
And it'll be a little challenging for us, I think, but also just a really great opportunity to explore the man before he was Dr. Middleton, this icon. So it's kind of fun, too.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of sussing out history, you are hosting in mid-November the Conference of the Genealogical Society of Marion County. Mm-hmm. You've done this before, I think?
We've worked with them before. I'm not sure we've actually hosted them at the building, but it's always wonderful because people don't think about historical organizations working together and genealogical organizations working together. So, you know, we put on our biannual conference called Midwestern Roots, which happened this summer. So it's really interesting to see how we can work with the local genealogical societies. There's a state group as well. So we're always happy to be able to help those organizations host something big.
And what happens at that kind of a conference?
You really get to learn a lot about how to do genealogy, what some of the latest and greatest techniques are in many cases. And we're not actually formulating the curriculum for this particular event.
You're just hosting them. Yeah,
but,
I get
you know,
it.
You can get things out of these kinds of events, whether you're a beginner, whether you're, you've been doing it for maybe a couple of years and you're just looking to break through to a new layer of your family history, or you've been doing it for decades. You know, people are always looking for new and exciting ways to find out information and to connect with people who might have information that is of interest to them as well.
Mm-hmm. And I know that these are not the only things on your plate. You have some other big projects coming up in November that are taking a lot of time.
Well, November, I think the town hall series is our biggest one. Really, December is when we start getting a little
crazy.
Thank you. Yes, a little crazy. Of course, the holidays are coming up, and we've got some wonderful plans to decorate our building, which are going to be just amazing. And then we will again be hosting Winterfest, which Winterfest this year will be taking place the last week in December and the first week in January. Mm-hmm. And these are days where we have added activities, performances, crafts, games, just all kinds of fun stuff for families to come out and enjoy. We know it's a lot of, you know, some downtime. The kids are out of school. You're looking for something to do. They've already opened
up
all their presents.
They've already played with all their toys.
Yeah,
they're
done.
They're bored.
So, you know, we invite people to come to the Historical Society, you know, go through the exhibitions, and then take advantage of the extra fun stuff that we have planned.
Yeah, and before the holidays as well. You know, I think we're becoming known. We've been known for years for our Christmas story, a Christmas story tie-in. We do have a full-scale vignette of the living room on Christmas morning. I'm really hoping we've gotten the adult bunny suits repaired because I just was looking at the picture before I came over here of a whole family, and they had put on the two adult bunny costumes, the two kid bunny costumes, and they had taken – a lot of people come and take their – holiday
family
postcard
photo. With the leg lamp?
There is a leg lamp in there.
And a Red Ryder BB gun.
Everything that you can ever want. And then, of course, we do have our author fair the first Saturday in December as well. So more than 75 authors, all having ties to Indiana. A lot of them come in and they'll also do presentations for us in the Basile Theater. So if you want to learn a little bit more from an author, you can either talk to them one-on-one or go to their presentation. It's really just a wonderful holiday shopping opportunity. And the Indiana Experience is open as well, so you can really make a day of it.
Sharon Gamble with Aaron Kelly and Amy Lamb from the Indiana Historical Society. Learn more about the African-American physician, Dr. Harvey Middleton, in the You Are There exhibit, Healing Bodies, Changing Minds, opening November 13th at the Indiana History Center. You can find out more about events, activities, and exhibits at indianahistory.org.
Trick or treat!
Wow, what great costumes you have there. Sharon, what are you wearing?
It's radio. We leave it to their imagination.
Well, it's the best costume I've ever seen you in.
Ooh, likewise, I'm sure. Are you ready to go door to door and scare up some fun arts events for our listeners?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that and a great pumpkin, too. Mm-hmm. On that calendar we call...
What'll we boo? You do scary voices so much better than I.
Oh, so frightening, so frightening. Hey, something that wasn't frightening at all, I just need to give a huge shout out to the Half-Step Sisters, otherwise known as Katie Burke and Julia Conway, because they were on the duet show last weekend on Prairie Home Companion.
That's right.
And out of, I mean, literally like thousands and thousands of duet groups that competed to get on the show, or at least 750, six duet finalists were chosen, and they ended up placing third. A very honorable third, so congratulations. And I thought they sounded just great and very, very fun. You can actually check out the Half-Step Sisters on their Facebook page to find out where they're playing locally.
Excellent. Here's something that might be a wee bit scary. If you're listening Thursday night, you can take advantage of this. If you're listening Saturday morning, oh, no.
You
missed it. Oh, very scary. Music of the Night this Friday, that's October 26th at 7 o'clock, Broadway United Methodist Church, with the Indianapolis Children's Choir and Martin Ellis, who's a wonderful organist. It's family-friendly, spooky music with a Halloween theme and lots of surprises, and you're welcome to come in costume. It promises to be the Indianapolis Children's Choir as you've never seen them before.
Ooh.
So Friday night at 7, if you're listening Saturday morning, I hope you were there.
Hey, I'm not making this up, Sharon. There's
a new gallery
that is opening coming up this Friday called the Monster Gallery. That's right, just in time for Halloween, or actually a couple days later, because it's opening on November 2nd. Okay, and so this is the new gallery that Mab Graves and Larry Endicott are opening up at 1702 English Avenue. That's at the intersection of State and English. And for the first show that the two of them are doing, and Larry is a phenomenal photographer, and Mab does just beautiful, beautiful paintings and illustrations and really fun sculptures and very... sort of illustrative, cartoony, with a little spooky feel to it sometimes. Well, her latest collection of work is called Candyland, and it's inspired by the 1950s Milton Bradley game, and it's a collection of over 50 new paintings, illustrations, miniatures, sculptures, all chronicling a little girl's adventures through the immortal land of candy, as she meets a whole new cast of characters, a little bit different from the ones that we grew up with. So, this show, which I cannot wait for, it's going to be so much fun. Again, November 2nd, it opens from 6 to 10 p.m., and the first 200 attendees are going to receive a special free commemorative Candyland gift. And that's at the new Monster Gallery, again, at 1702 English Avenue. I can't wait.
what a treat.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, if you like tango music, I have a treat, no trick for you this coming Sunday. That's October 28th at 3 o'clock over at Grand Hall Indiana Landmark Center. The Indianapolis Violin Competition, International Violin Competition of Indianapolis, brings back its 94 silver medalist, Stefan Milenkovic, a sight for sore eyes. I might add, and on top of that, a phenomenal player. He has connected with a group called Ars Tango that does this performance that tells the story and the history of tango music. So that is coming up this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Doesn't it sound fun? And I don't know that there will be actual dancing, but you'll certainly want to dance while you're listening to that concert. You can get more information by calling the violin competition at 637-4574 or visit, weren't they smart to capture this URL early, violin.org.
Well done. Hey, at the Phoenix Theater, opening on October 25th and running through November 25th, the play Seminar, which is a comedy about basically a fiction writing class, sort of a writer's workshop. It's got a great tagline that young writers are like good books. You can't enjoy them until you've broken their spines. That sounds awful. So it's actually about four young fiction writers and working with their over-the-hill writer turned teacher. And if anyone's been in a fiction writing class or seminar, you will enjoy this. And if you haven't, well, I'm sure you can imagine that it's actually worse than what you think it is. And that's going to be the fun part. It's called Seminar, and it's at the Phoenix Theater.
And it's an acting stretch for the kind and gentle Bill Simmons, who plays the Alan Rickman role. Alan Rickman played that role on Broadway. Here's something scary. It's coming up on Monday at 7:30, and it's Echoing Scare at the University of Indianapolis, a kind of a little bit of a pun there, the dynamic period instrument ensemble Echoing Air, playing some scary music for you at 7:30 on Monday.
Very cool, very cool. Hey, we'll be back with more things that maybe aren't too scary once we get past the Halloween weekend, but everyone have a great Halloween out there.
Send us your chocolate.
Send us your chocolate if you got some. And we'll see you next week on that calendar we call
What'll We Boo?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Art of the Matter listeners may remember that last spring, Travis DiNicola interviewed IUPUI English drama professor Dr. Terry Burris and Shakespeare scholar Dr. Gary Taylor about their production of the play Cardenio at IUPUI's new theater. Cardenio is a lost Shakespeare play that Taylor has spent 20 years reconstructing. Coming to WFYI TV 20 on November 1st is a documentary about Taylor and Burris's work titled CSI Shakespeare. It was created by WFYI's Emmy Award-winning producer Jim Simmons. Travis talked with Jim about his new documentary. We'll listen to that interview first, then we'll hear part of Travis's original interview from last spring.
Jim, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you.
Nice to see you again, Travis.
Up here in radio, just down the hall from TV. But I'm thrilled that you're on today. We're going to listen in just a minute to an interview that I did last spring with Dr. Terry Burris and Dr. Gary Taylor about the play Cardenio that they recreated. I mean, there's a lot of basically that they brought back to life. And it's a really neat story. But the reason that I wanted to have a chance to chat with you, because they did this play last spring at IUPUI, because you have created a documentary that is airing on WFYI on November 1st, CSI Shakespeare. And this is just as cool, I think, as all the work that they've been doing. I mean, what you've been doing in documenting this process.
Right. It's been a very interesting project because everyone's going to hear in just a few minutes about Gary Taylor's research and about Terry bringing this play to life. And it's a Shakespeare play. It's actually Shakespeare and John Fletcher. But the backstory real quick is that that play didn't survive. It was plagiarized by another very untalented author, and that's how it's come down through history to us. And we also know that it's based on Don Quixote. So what we've got is a 20-year effort to pare away the Theobald and Cervantes in this and find the Shakespeare Fletcher underneath. What's been very interesting about turning this into a TV show is that if you think about it, this is a gentleman that's gone through this script line by line, and he's matched it up with all the Shakespeare works, Theobald works, Fletcher, 18th century, 17th, you know, he has done this line by line, and we're making a TV show out of it. So what we've said is our goal is to make a Shakespeare show for people who are uncertain about Shakespeare and want to know more about him and may even come away from the show liking Shakespeare quite a bit. And in some senses, we've also said it's a little bit of Sound of Music, because we do a lot of, it's true, we do a lot of interviews in a lot of different locations. If you've ever seen the musical numbers from Sound of Music,
sure,
where they jump around, you will see a lot of jumping here.
And but this is a 30-minute documentary, so you are packing a lot into a half hour here.
We are doing our very best. In fact, for those of out there who are longtime listeners, we even have an interview with Dorothy Webb, who's from the IU theater IUPUI theater program,
right,
from many,
sure,
many years ago. She has a great story for you guys out there that I have to tell you a little bit about.
Yeah.
The very first IUPUI theater was actually in a building that was had a swimming pool. So the shallow end of the pool was the high end of the theater. The low end of the pool was where the stage was. And the sloping part from shallow to deep end is where all the theater seats were.
Wow.
So we've got, you're right, we've got, and plus we have a trip with Gary, mm-hmm, Taylor to the Globe Theater, or the recreation of the Globe in London.
Neat.
So, yeah, fasten your seatbelts, because this is going to really fly, we hope.
This is, I'm very excited about this. I mean, I was excited when I heard that that Gary was bringing this here. I knew about his work, and it was a great way to inaugurate the new theater at IUPUI, and of course with the work that Terry Boris has been doing with those students. But now to sort of go back and relive it and see how it all came together. You got to tell me about where this title CSI Shakespeare came from. I mean, I love the title. It makes a lot of sense with all the sort of detective work that's gone into this.
I think most of the people who are listening right now know Rita Kahn. And Rita Kahn is a playwright, an author, an aficionado of almost everything arts, yes, and cultural that exists,
great,
in this
lady,
town.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually approached us. She said, I hear there's something going on over at IUPUI that you should all know about. The other thing, and I think this is going to come up in the interview you're about to listen to, is this: there's a new urban theater space in the center of the campus, and this show actually christened the opening of that theater,
yeah,
space. So Rita said, you know, this is like everything you can think of. This is Shakespeare, this is research, this is arts, this is theater, and you guys got to get involved in this. So we're actually over there taping this opening night. And she just made a casual remark. She just was smiling, and she went, CSI Shakespeare, and then kind of laughed. And you just stopped for a minute and said, yep, that's pretty much it. That's
what
the title.
It is.
Yep. Yeah,
that's great. Well, Jim, this—I'm sure this has been a lot of fun for you to work on. Very cool project. Congratulations, and I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, it's been great. Everybody has been, everybody at IUPUI, everybody associated with the university and with the show itself has just been absolutely fabulous. And we hope everybody enjoys it.
Travis DiNicola with WFYI's CSI Shakespeare producer Jim Simmons. Now we'll hear Travis's original interview from last spring with Dr. Terry Burris and Dr. Gary Taylor.
I know that you both have to be very excited about what's going on. Essentially a new play, a new theater. I'm not sure which is more exciting. I know you've both been planning this for quite a while, but ladies first, Terry, we get to start talking about the fact that you have a theater now at IUPUI, something that you and the,
yeah,
students and everyone's wanted for quite a long time have been working towards.
Yes, we've been working hard to get a theater on the campus of IUPUI. There are so many dynamic students and talented students and faculty on the campus, and as we increasingly feel the presence of IUPUI in and around the city of Indianapolis, what could be better than to have an urban campus have a theater and link in to the arts world at
absolutely,
in Indianapolis.
Well, and you've been, I mean, doing theater at IUPUI for quite a while and using different stages. I mean, you know, working,
yeah,
with the Fringe Theater and such. But so now you have your own home. Where is it on campus?
Okay, we are on the corner of University and Michigan.
Okay.
Right in the middle of campus in the campus center.
Right,
and
where the bookstore is.
Yeah.
And, yeah, okay.
Starbucks and the bookstore,
yeah,
and all that cool stuff. And it's that campus center came with me to IUPUI 4.5 years ago. So I've watched it develop,
mm-hmm,
and get
develop as a heart, as the heart of the campus.
It really, really is. I mean, mm-hmm. I've been there for a number of events and conferences and such, and at any given time of day, it seems it's just packed with students and faculty and people doing different things, and it's a very lively center. And there's, you know, food and stuff. So in that building, which is a great, gorgeous big building, where is your theater?
It's on the garden level, or dare I say, the basement. But it's beautiful because
it's the foundation.
Exactly. There you go.
It's the foundation. Thank you, Gary. That's great. It is on the ground level or the basement of the campus center, and it's got 248 seats and a beautiful stage. And we're getting ready to mount a fabulous production on that stage. And I can just feel the buzz of the campus. The students are dancing around and putting up flyers up and down Mass Ave, and mm-hmm. you, of course, you've always been a great support for the IUPUI.
Everyone's very excited about this, and again, not just because it's a great, you know, it's a new theater in mm-hmm. town, which is a big deal, but you know, how often do you get to see a new Shakespearean play performed for the first time? I mean, I know you know, from an academic standpoint, this is not exactly the case, but Gary, help me understand, what is this? Because, you know, I've heard people say, oh, it's a lost play, it's the first production. I know there's been a reading of this before. You've been working on this for quite a while as well.
Yes. Well, there have been a series of readings, and I've been working on it for 20 years, among other things. Mm-hmm. But and part of the reason I've been working on it so long is that when I first started, some of the tools that were needed to solve the problem of this play weren't available. You need massive databases of early literature. And in order to be able to distinguish one person's writing from another person's writing. So although this is talked about as the lost play, if it were a really lost play, it would be lost.
Right, and then
you can't perform
it?
A lost play. I suppose it would be like a Beckett play. Nobody would say anything for 3 hours. But what we actually have is a play that survives only in fragments.
Okay.
And the problem is to identify which fragments are authentic and which have been interfered with. And then once you've done that scholarly work, which is what requires the databases and a lot of very specialist kind of techniques, and that's where my, you know, Shakespeare scholar hat comes in and Shakespeare editor. Once you've done all of that, what you've got is a collection of fragments, and you have to figure out which order they belong in. Mm-hmm. But you also then have to figure out what's missing and how to fill in the gap.
Sure.
And fortunately, the lost play...
I mean, it almost sounds like restoring a painting or
something. Well, it is very much like that. Or the new Beethoven symphony, mm-hmm. where, you know, bits of it are missing. And so what you've then got to do, fortunately, we know that the play was inspired by Don Quixote, one of mm-hmm. the great, you know, works of
the world.
Many
people consider
the
first novel.
The first novel, mm-hmm. the first modern, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a modern novel, and an extraordinarily entertaining but also moving story. And so we know it was inspired by this great book.
Mm-hmm.
But we also know that Shakespeare and his collaborator on the play, a younger playwright named John Fletcher, which probably almost no one listening to this will recognize that name, but for almost a century he was considered a greater playwright than Shakespeare, more
really?
Popular and more admired for a very long time. And he's the one who succeeded Shakespeare as the leading playwright in the okay. leading company in London.
Was it just that a lot of his works did not survive, or...?
No, it's that it's partly a question of tastes in drama.
Yeah. Okay.
But in any case, and it also has to do with the fact that Fletcher, most of his plays are written in collaboration,
mm-hmm.
and so he doesn't have as strong a personal identity as Shakespeare does,
okay.
an individual style. And again, it's taken scholars centuries to figure out which bits of these collaborative plays he wrote.
Mm-hmm. Was this play produced, performed closer to the end of Shakespeare's life?
Yes,
is that correct?
It's at the very end of Shakespeare's life.
Okay.
In fact, it's the first thing he worked on after he wrote The Tempest, which people consider his last play.
Sure.
But in fact, he wrote three more plays after that, but they were all written in collaboration with John Fletcher.
I see.
The younger, mm-hmm. so it was a sort of cross-generational double act. And so we know that the play was a big success when it was first performed because it was performed twice within a couple of months at court, and only the best plays got invited to court at all, and to be called
sure.
back again so quickly indicated that it was a big success. So the problem then moves sort of beyond ordinary Shakespeare scholarship into the theater. And as you know, Terry and I are working on the new Oxford Shakespeare Project here in Indianapolis. We have always had the idea that in order to edit Shakespeare, you have to think of him as a theater artist. As I say, once you've got all of these fragments together, you then have to decide what's missing and how to replace it.
As opposed to a literary author.
Right? As opposed to a literary author. Mm-hmm. A theater author.
Yes.
He writes for the theater, and so did Fletcher. Mm-hmm. And they were both veterans, and they were both really good at writing for live theatrical performance. So what I've been doing over the 20 years I've been working on this is I've been trying it out with readings in different theater companies, different actors, different directors. And so, and those began in New York at the New York Public Theater, was the first reading 20 years ago. And I discovered, you know, I still had a lot of work to do because actors and directors can tell you things that computers can't.
Sure.
And
you often don't realize that. I mean, you can't just read it, but I mean, until you get up on the stage and try to perform it, you don't come across those things that either, yes, absolutely, this flows and works right, or something stumbles. Or,
that's
or
right. Sure. And one of the problems with having fragments is you don't necessarily, even if you know that this was written by Shakespeare or this was written by Fletcher, you don't necessarily know what order it's supposed to be in. And since the theater is an art form which is all about time, theater exists, it's, you know, in the same way that a sculptor works in stone, theater works in time. Mm-hmm. And so the sequence in which you do things and is enormously important. But also,
I can imagine you have to have incredibly talented and knowledgeable actors to be
able
to get
that
information.
Well, that's it. But
well,
also a variety of different kinds of actors. Yeah. Because, I mean, the most recent reading of the script was at the Shakespeare's Globe in London in November. And Terry and I both attended that. And we worked with the director beforehand. Mm-hmm. And there were some wonderful performances in that, but there were also some terrible performances in that. And so what you have to do is to, and this is part of the reason for doing it with different groups, is figure out, is this a problem with the script, or is this just a problem with that particular actor?
Yeah.
Fortunately, we have a fabulous cast for this show. And maybe you could say more about that, a fabulous cast of actors and also musicians, because there's a lot of music in this show as well.
Very good, yeah.
Terry, yeah, please. We do. And thank you, Gary, because I really want to talk about the students and the actors in Indianapolis.
And this, again, is not a reading. This is a full production.
This is a full production.
Costumes. The history of, let me make sure I have it pronounced correctly, Cardenio?
Yes, The History of Cardenio. It's a story that was embedded within the story of Don Quixote and Sancho Panza in Don Quixote. Shakespeare, you know, Stanley Wells always said that Shakespeare wrote really good plays as long as someone else wrote the story first. So we'll see. But this is a challenging play because it is a cast of 22. And we have brought in four wonderful, talented musicians from IUPUI and the dancing company, the moving company, choreographed by Paige Craigie, who runs that program. And it's buried in the Department of Physical Education at IUPUI now.
Okay.
So we all have a common goal to create a performing arts center at IUPUI and bring music and acting and dancing under one umbrella, as they should be.
Mm-hmm.
But right now we're able to do that with our play. It's we've got 47 cast and crew. It's a very big production. It's got a very
people
big
don't write
ending.
Plays like that anymore.
No,
you can't afford to,
not at all. And so it's a challenge to orchestrate that many people, and it's a challenge for the actors to be in a brand new theater that's never had the lights on yet, and with a brand new script. That has had readings, but has not been performed in its entirety.
Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. Terry, I'm not trying to second guess you here, mm-hmm. but most people would do one or the other. You know, either have a new theater with a play that's pretty well established, or vice versa. Yes. But
Terry Morris is not most people, I have to say.
Well, I'm jumping in. I'm not sure, feet first or head first, yeah. And hope I don't drown. But the actors are really, and the crew are so terrific, and everybody's doing their part and pulling their weight, and the Campus Center is working hard to get that everything in order so that when we open the doors, we can present Indianapolis with a new old Shakespeare play on a new, brand new grand opening of the theater at the Campus Center at IUPUI.
And I know you're doing a lot of events that are tied into this, lectures beforehand, things like that as well. It's not just the play, of course, but it's also going to be a great educational experience for the students and the community.
Thank you for mentioning that, because we have free public lectures every day that we perform. And then we have a graduate colloquium for those who are studying Shakespeare out there. We have
or
a graduate
Cervantes,
colloquium.
Cervantes as well.
Thank you, yes. Or Fletcher.
Yes.
A Friday, the 27th of April, is the graduate colloquium. And all day on the 28th, we have top scholars in the field of early modern drama and Shakespeare and Cervantes coming to speak.
And they're coming from all over the world as well. To this event in Indianapolis. We have people coming from France and England and New Zealand and Australia. This is a culmination of a long process which is both theatrical and scholarly, and which sort of demonstrates our mantra, which is that theater is research, is itself a form of research, and it belongs at a research university. And especially belongs at an urban research university, because theater is an urban art form. It always has been.
Travis DiNicola with Shakespeare scholars Drs. Terry Burris and Gary Taylor. You can see WFYI's documentary CSI Shakespeare, created by Jim Simmons, on November 1st at 7:30 p.m. on WFYI 1 Public Television. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week at our new time, Thursdays at 8 p.m. and Saturdays at 7 a.m., when I learn about an anniversary celebration at the Madam Walker Theater.
I'll chat with poet Norbert Croft about his new book of poems.
And I get to chat with Only a Games host Bill Littlefield. We'll be in town for the Spirit in Place Festival. Plus, we'll have that calendar of events we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.